This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by noted actor and activist Mike Farrell to talk about the death penalty in America and what's happening in Arkansas.
In 1988, he founded the organization Death Penalty Focus. We've made progress since then, except for Arkansas.
We're joined by attorney Stephen Pagalis to talk about medical malpractice laws.
Are these suits frivolous? Is there a crisis affecting insurance companies? Stephen Pagalis is one of the outstanding trial lawyers in America. Let's hear what he has to say.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The state of Arkansas had planned to execute 8 men in 11 days, rushing to do so before the expiration date of one of the drugs used in lethal injections. The executions were temporarily stayed by several court orders. Arkansas's unseemly rush has raised anew questions about the efficacy, humanity, cost, and morality of capital punishment. Statistically, it has a discriminatory impact on non-white, intellectually deficient, and poor people. The United States, along with Saudi Arabia and China, is one of the few developed countries in the world still using the death penalty. We're joined today by actor and activist Mike Farrell, president and founder, in 1988, of the San Francisco-based organization Death Penalty Focus. DPF views the death penalty as an ineffective, cruel, and inappropriate response to the serious problem of violent crime. The organization provides information to the public, conducts media campaigns, and is a resource to lawyers and educators across the nation. Mike Farrell, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
There's been a debate about the issue of whether the death penalty is a deterrent. Does it prevent future crimes?
Oh, gee, I think there is no serious evidence that shows the death penalty to be a deterrent. There are arguments back and forth. There have been over time. I think the only people that maintain seriously that the death penalty is a deterrent are prosecutors who want to make the case and politicians who are too cowardly to face the reality of the death penalty and want to use it as an excuse to keep supporting it. The fact is, if in order for something to be a deterrent, it would have to be immediate, to be pertinent. Today, here in California, for example, it takes 25 years between the time from the time of a conviction to the time of an execution, if the execution were to ever happen. Over time, in most of the states of the union, I know in Arkansas, the state that's under scrutiny today, people are on death row for 20 years at times, and there's certainly no deterrent value to something like that.
We want to talk about the Arkansas cases, but I also want to ask, do you think capital punishment can be maintained without racial bias?
Not in America. I think the racism that still is a very real aspect of our society here in this country obviates the possibility of capital punishment being race conscious or unconscious about race. If there is a country that has no racism, I suppose it's possible, but certainly not in the United States of America, nor in any country that is of which I'm aware today.
What about wealth? Has a rich man or a rich man's son ever received the death penalty?
I'm unaware of the possibility that it may have happened at some point. But I think the question really goes to whether or not people who are wealthy get the same justice as people who are not. And the answer is no. Probably the most famous case that demonstrates that is the case of O.J. Simpson, the man who could afford to hire what they called the dream team, who was able to get him off in a case in which I think the evidence indicated, at least, that he was guilty. But the unfortunate aspect of the death penalty system in our country and the legal system in general is that those who can afford, those who have the money to afford a who are accused of a serious crime and have the money to afford a serious defense can usually avoid serious punishment.
On the issue of how jurors decide whether or not to impose death, they have to balance what are called aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And the instructions they receive are very often so confusing they don't really understand how that works. But you mentioned the issue of legal representation. How does the quality of the kind of lawyer and the resources that attorney might have impact on how capital punishment is imposed in different states?
Well, different states is a big question. Some states have funded death penalty defense attorneys or public defenders, or sometimes they're known. Others use court-appointed lawyers. I'm not sure if there's a state that, today in America that doesn't provide any kind of defense. I think that's not, that would be illegal. But the broad differences, the extraordinary differences in the capability of people who are trained as opposed to people who are just sort of selected by a judge to defend an indigent defendant, is stark. And what we see generally, I think it's become kind of axiomatic in legal circles that the death penalty is usually dealt out to those who have the worst lawyer rather than the ones who are the most guilty.
Does a death sentence cost less than a life without parole sentence?
Oh, by no means. It's just the reverse. The death penalty costs far more than life without parole. There was a study done here again in California, but it's the same in many states in the union. A study done here in California in 2011, conducted by a member of the California Supreme Court who was not a death penalty opponent, and his law clerk. And that study showed that we spend here in California $184 million every year simply to maintain the death system. Whether we kill anybody or not, that's cost us, at that time, the calculation was it cost us $4 billion from the time of 1979 when the death penalty was reinstated here to that current moment. And at the same time, we had spent $11 million to maintain the system of LWOP, as it's called, or life without parole. We used to say, those of us who studied the issue used to say that it costs at least three times more to go through the process and put somebody to death than it does to keep that person in prison for the rest of his or her natural life. But that figure was actually has been shown to be deflated, that in fact it costs far more than that. The difference is far more dramatic than that.
Mike, our criminal justice system, as most of our listeners know, is one that is highly retributive, and our punishment system, at times, a draconian one. Is imposition of the death penalty the most effective or the only way to give closure to the families of victims?
Well, personally, I consider closure a creature of the prosecutorial forces. People I know in the have met over the years in this work have indicated to me that there is no such thing as closure when you lose a loved one. A man particularly said he was outraged at the idea that he would be given closure when the death of the perpetrator of the crime that killed his son, he said, my son will never be back. He's never going to be returned to me. Well, how dare you suggest I'm going to get closure at the death of another human being? So the notion, I believe, this unfair and really a kind of pandering idea on the parts of prosecutors that living members of their loved ones of a victim will be somehow, their emotional pain will be resolved at the death of the perpetrator of the crime, assuming they get the right person, is really a fallacy.
One of the bases for our criminal justice system is that we'd rather set a guilty person free than condemn an innocent one. Can you share any instances of innocent persons being executed?
It's very difficult, once someone is executed, to determine factually whether or not she or he was innocent. And that's because those in authority in the given states don't want to allow examinations that could demonstrate that fact, because it would put them at risk for having killed an innocent human being. But what we know colloquially and anecdotally is that a man by the name of Cameron Todd Willingham in Texas was executed for an arson fire that killed his, I believe, three children. And it was only sometime after he was executed that the experts who had used their what was known then as expertise on the case to examine the evidence were soundly refuted, and real experts were brought in to demonstrate that the evidence supposedly that demonstrated his guilt was all wrong, and Cameron Todd Willingham was no less dead. And in fact, another man in Texas under the same circumstances was exonerated sometime after that on the basis of the same problem, only that in his case the evidence was properly examined by an expert, and the man was freed. In another case in Texas, Carlos de Luna, there's a very good book about it now called The Wrong Carlos. A man by the name of Carlos de Luna was executed for a murder that another man not only committed but admitted having committed, but this was after de Luna was killed. Ruben Cantu was the third young man in Texas who was executed for a crime that one of the witnesses later recanted and told the story that exonerated him. And in that case, Sam Millsap was a Texas prosecutorial officer who examined the evidence again and gave up his job, and he no longer supports the death penalty because he feels he was responsible for the death of an innocent man. There's a man here in California, actually, Thomas Thompson, who many people looking at the evidence suggest that was executed for a crime he didn't commit. And it was interestingly written up by a member of the California State Supreme Court in a law review, in which he said that, I can't quite quote him, but he said that this is the first time in the state's history that a man was executed without the full adjudication of the facts, because there was a technical flap that was created in the Supreme Court that was overridden, in the California Supreme Court, that was overridden by the U.S. Supreme Court, and Tom Thompson was executed in spite of the fact that they had not yet fully resolved the case.
What methods have been used and are currently used to execute people in the United States?
Well, we started historically with lynching or hanging, and I believe the thing that followed that officially was the electric chair, the invention of the electric chair. Subsequent to that, gas was used. Firing squad is still used in one state, and actually is on the books in another, and is being considered in a third and maybe a fourth today. The lethal injection process that is used pretty generally today, with the exception of the state, I think, of Utah, is the chosen method today, the three-drug protocol, as it is called, where they use a sedative to put the person to sleep, in theory, then they use another drug to paralyze the victim, the person to be executed, and a third to stop his heart or her heart. That is the one that is generally used today, but it's running into so many problems, as have the others. Each method that has been used historically has been thought to be the perfect, if you will, answer to this need to figure out a way to humanely kill somebody. And we have found historically that these things are not humane and they are not appropriate and that they make mistakes. Lethal injection was shown to be the perfect example. You could quietly put somebody to sleep and end his life or her life. But we have now discovered the same problems exist with lethal injection as with the other methods, and we were faced with this continuing problem of trying to find a humane way to kill a human being, which is an inhumane act, and the two simply do not jive.
Mike, there's been a lot of public attention to the situation in Arkansas. Mm. And one of the issues is that the drug distributors went to court to prevent their drug from being used, alleging that they had been tricked into providing it to the state. Can you tell us give us a summary of the case for listeners who may not be aware of it?
Sure. That's actually happening now more and more. The three drugs that I mentioned are used to anesthetize or to put the person to sleep, the second to paralyze her or him, and the third to stop the heart. The third drug that's used to stop the heart is explained by medical practitioners to be terribly, terribly painful. So the first two are to avoid the pain. Over time, a number of different drugs have been used to induce sleep, and some have been less effective than others. And the more effective ones have been challenged in their use so many times that the manufacturers have now taken the position, because they created these drugs for medicinal purposes to help people heal, that it's inappropriate for it to be used to kill people. The second drug, the paralytic, is the one that is now under challenge by the manufacturer in Arkansas, and they said the same thing. They said this is a drug we've developed for humane purposes, not for inhumane purposes, and we challenge the state because they did not tell us that they were going to use this drug to kill people. That it's not the reason for the manufacture of this drug, and we don't want it used for that reason, in that way. So we are kind of hoist on a petard of our own making. The drug that is currently expected to be used if the executions go forward in Arkansas is a drug called midazolam, which is one they have now come to as a result of having been stricken of the use of these other drugs by the manufacturers, unwillingness to provide them. And midazolam has a very, very iffy history. It's been demonstrated by many medical and chemical experts to not do what the state claims it does, which is to put somebody in a deep sleep long enough for the other drugs to do their act. And we have a history now of cases where they've created what are known in the trade as botched executions, where individuals have either not been sufficiently sedated or have awakened during the process and have been in excruciating pain, writhing and moaning. And in one case, a man in Arizona for almost 2 hours was put through the agony of a slow, torturous death, which is antithetical to the ideas indicated in the Constitution that we would not ever subject someone to cruel or unusual punishment.
Mike, remind us, is a medical professional on site during the actual execution? Why would 2 hours be allowed to go by without injecting that final drug?
In most states, as I understand it, first of all, the medical profession has taken a strong position that no doctor should take part in an execution process. Doctors are there to heal people, not kill them. There are some doctors who have decided to avoid or ignore that proscription and instead take part in the process. But in most instances in the states, the people who do the actual injection and the entire execution process are prison guards who are trained to whatever degree to go through this process. And in the case of Joe Woods in Arizona, they re-injected him a number of times. They ended up using 5 or 10 times the amount of this drug that that was prescribed to be effective with one injection. We have found in the case of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma, for example, the injection was placed in the wrong part of his body. It went into muscle rather than into the bloodstream. Here in California, our death penalty protocol has been stayed legally for the last 11 years because it was challenged, and the judge found that the processes used by the state and the people trained by the state were not sufficiently able to do the job. So it's a cruel and hideous procedure in the first place to subject people to. I know in Virginia, in a case I was involved in, the organization, the woman who ran the organization, a wonderful woman named Marie Deans, was not only counseling death row inmates who, at the time of prior to their execution, and doing everything she could to help them. She also was asked for help by the people on what they call the death squad, people who were involved in the process of killing her clients, because of the extreme emotional stress involved with the taking of the life of a human being.
Is this case in Arkansas the most unusual one that you've seen, in that it's kind of like an assembly line?
It is very much so, and it's frightening. You know, they were intending, and let me say it at the outset, it's outrageous that the state, for its own convenience, has determined that because the drug, the midazolam, being the drug that I mentioned earlier, the one that is to be the anesthetic that's to put the person to sleep, the sedative, because their supply of this drug is going to be is going to expire. Its power is supposed to expire at the end of this month. That for that reason, they determined that they were going to kill 8 people within a period of 10 or 11 days. And it was going to be 2 people per day for 4 days. You're quite right to use the term assembly line. I mean, this whole idea, forgive me, but it's Nazi-like to experiment with human life like this and to experiment with imposed death like this. They were going to put their, forgetting the inappropriateness of this execution process and forgetting the inappropriateness of killing these individuals, they were going to put their execution teams through something that I think would be emotionally traumatic to the point of despair. There are cases where individuals have left the profession because of what they've gone through in inducing death on an individual. There's a former overseer of executions in Texas who said he can't sleep at night because he keeps seeing the eyes of the individuals who he witnessed being put to death and was instrumental in that process. We forget that we're human beings and that human beings have a need and a desire to live and to be part of the process that takes that eliminates that need and that desire on the part of another human being who opposes its being done to him or her, is, it seems to me, contrary to everything we claim to be as a civilized society.
Mike, what progress have we seen in rolling back the death penalty, particularly since your organization, Death Penalty in Focus, was formed back in, I think, 1988? But are you encouraged by the general trend?
By the general trend, yes. I'm very frustrated by the pace, but I'm very encouraged by the general trend. When I got involved in this issue many years ago and have traveled across the country, I've seen evidence that the system is racist in application, that it's really, as you've suggested earlier, only used against the poor and the poorly defended, that it is hideously expensive, and that it entraps and kills innocent people. There's no excuse for any of these being part of an endorsed process by the people of the United States. Early on, the polls told us, contrary to what was happening in the 40s and 50s, you know, the majority of the people in this country opposed the death penalty, and the death penalty wasn't used all that often. But in the 60s, in my view, at the beginning of the death treadmill, the Nixon administration really used being tough on crime as a kind of whip to generate a lot of enthusiasm politically. And they really kind of moved the clock. And there was a point then, probably mid-80s, where about 80 to 85% of the public, according to the Gallup polls, was pro-death penalty because they had been flogged with these terrible stories and indications that it was going to be could be done very safely and appropriately and get rid of the worst of the worst, as the United States Supreme Court called them. But over time, with educating people, with getting them the reality, one of the great justices, who's I'm blanking on his name, said that if the American people saw and understood the real way the process happens, there would be no death penalty in this country. So what we've tried to do, I think, in the abolition movement is bring people an awareness of the reality of this, not only the system, the way it works, the inappropriateness of it, but also the fact that the options that are available to people, the rehabilitation of some people, the incarceration of people until the rest and for the rest of their lives, are available to us as a society. We have begun to shift to the point that the most recent Gallup poll showed that less than a majority of the people in this country are openly supportive of the death penalty. That information, unfortunately, hasn't gotten to the United States Supreme Court yet or to a significant number of politicians who continue to use this whole notion of being tough on crime as something to flog their reputations and demonstrate how courageous they are in terms of being willing to take a life.
Mike Farrell, how did you go from being a successful actor to getting involved in the abolitionist movement?
Well, I was always opposed to the death penalty. My work as an actor simply provided a little more public visibility so that I could speak to the issues that I'd been speaking to before when nobody knew who I was or cared. And when I was lucky enough to get a role in one of the great television series of all time, MASH, it provided a platform for me to give voice to the things I'd been concerned about for many years, one of them being prison reform and the death penalty, another being the end of a war that was a deeply wrong and unpopular war, and some of the more powerful movements in our country, the women's rights movement, the Black Power movement, the Brown Revolution, the gay revolution, the very things that really have worked toward making this the society that we want it to be. But the difference between being somebody who was in a demonstration and carried a sign and nobody knew, the difference being that made by my position as a star of one of the television's greatest series, opportunity for me to not only speak my mind, but also have opportunities to go to different parts of the country and different be involved in different cases and circumstances that have, I think, led to my understanding of how terribly, terribly harmful this process is to all of us, and hopefully my ability to convey that truth to other people.
Mike, as we say goodbye, please tell our listeners how they can learn more about Death Penalty Focus.
Sure. We're at www.deathpenalty.org. Any and all are welcome. We are based in California, as you suggested earlier, but we operate across the country. Ours is the largest, I believe, one of the largest, certainly, abolition organizations in the country, and we operate internationally as well. Although, as you know, internationally, the death penalty is frowned upon rather generally, and here in the United States, we continue to be the sole developed Western nation, certainly, that continues to use this practice.
Much to our embarrassment and shame.
Indeed.
Mike Farrell, it's been an honor to have you on with us. Thank you so much for your really critical work.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks.
Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
House of Representatives recently introduced a bill to limit medical malpractice lawsuits brought by low-income people on Medicaid and elderly people on Medicare. It would do so by limiting the amount they could recover for their pain and suffering caused by, for example, getting infected bedsores in a nursing home, a medication mix-up, malnutrition, dehydration, or being the victim of an egregious medical error, such as when a foreign body is left inside a patient, a baby's brain is damaged, or when surgery is performed on the wrong body part. The bill has the support of the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, and the American Healthcare Association, a trade group for nursing homes. The bill has several provisions that closely resemble legislation introduced by Tom Price, President Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services. When he was a House member from Georgia, Price, an orthopedic surgeon, championed legislation that would set limits on damages and make it easier for doctors to defend themselves in medical malpractice lawsuits. For decades, Republicans have charged that there is a medical malpractice lawsuit crisis brought about by frivolous lawsuits. We are joined today by Stephen Pagalis. He's a trial attorney who represents patients in medical malpractice claims. Attorney Pagalis is the author of the 3-volume textbook, The American Law of Medical Malpractice. He teaches the subject at New York Law School and is the co-director of the New York Law School Health Law and Patient Safety Project. Stephen Pagalis is the founding partner of Pagalis & Erickson, and one of the nation's foremost medical malpractice trial attorneys. He's been a lawyer in this area now for over 50 years.
Stephen Pagalis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, recently said that the new bill would limit, quote, frivolous lawsuits that unnecessarily drive up healthcare costs. Is there a medical malpractice insurance crisis, and is there lawsuit abuse?
If a physician or other provider of health care inadvertently but carelessly causes or contributes to patient injury, under our common law, that person is the wrongdoer, not a criminal, but a tortfeasor. That creates, under our law, an obligation to pay full and fair compensation, rooted in the moral concept that the careless wrongdoer or wrongdoers, not the innocent injured victim, should bear the moral and legal responsibility, and also rooted in the moral concept that the law demands due care and holds the wrongdoer accountable. Common law is what has been developed over time based on fairness and morality. The Seventh Amendment to the Constitution provides that in suits at common law, where the value exceeds $20, I don't know what that translates to currently, but you can follow the idea. It's an imposition on our citizens to serve on juries, so they should only serve on those issues that are important as measured by dollars and cents. But there's the right to trial by jury. It shall be preserved. It shall be reexamined by the courts and other rules, but otherwise the courts should not intervene. So the constitutions of each state have similar provisions. For example, if a jury found a patient was injured due to medical carelessness and lost vision in both eyes and awarded $20 million for pain, suffering, and loss of enjoyment of life, our court system could reduce that verdict to $10 million, for example, using precedent to determine what has been awarded in other cases. So there is a built-in our legal system, safety device, but could not reduce that verdict, for example, to $250,000, since no rational, reasonable person would believe that would be equivalent value for a lifetime of blindness. So the law builds into our system common sense and fairness with a moral basis. So I haven't forgotten your question, which was about Mr. Spicer commenting about laws to work against frivolous cases. Imposing a damage cap of $250,000, regardless of merit and regardless of the seriousness of injury.
Which is what the Republicans are proposing here.
Well, that's what the law, the change in the law presumes.
Yes.
Could not possibly influence what are called frivolous cases. A frivolous case is either one that has no merit. Well, if it has no merit and our legal system is presumed to work, then there'll be no damages awarded. If it does have merit, the amount of damages must be equal to the injury actually sustained. Nobody could rationally believe that an injury that causes loss of vision in one eye is equal to an injury that causes loss of vision in both eyes. No one could rationally believe that if the person who sustained that injury is 75 years of age, that it has equivalent value to someone who sustained that injury at 5 years of age. So it makes no sense. And to impose damage caps on the basis of preventing frivolous lawsuits, it makes no sense whatsoever. One might say that Mr. Spicer is promoting alternate facts, but these facts are not alternate to anything, since it's not a different fact. It's totally unconnected to the issue. To say that I'm opposed to caps on damages is obvious since it's totally inconsistent with the moral and legal purposes of our laws. And ironically, it would promote a circumstance in which people would be unable to bring cases. It would create an immunity. Immunity not only goes against the ethics and morality of our legal system, it goes against the ethics and morality of the medical system. Healthcare providers, physicians, have an ethic and a morality and a professionalism that requires them to be accountable. And it just erodes the basic meaning of what is intended for professionalism and ethics. It's counterintuitive and counterproductive.
Do you think there's lawsuit abuse? Is there some kind of flood of law cases against the medical profession that's going on right now?
It's interesting. The facts speak against that contention. For example, in New York State, for the past 2 years, there have been fewer claims in any years since 1995. So fewer lawsuits are being brought. There were, I think the statistic is 22% less cases. Yet, in that time interval, there's been an increase in population. There's been an increase in the number of physicians and hospitals, an increase in the number of instances in which there could be a legal case. And in that time interval, and if you'll give me an opportunity to speak on it, in the year 2001, the Institute of Medicine issued their landmark report titled To Err Is Human, setting forth the premise of why accountability is so important. And since that time, healthcare has become safer. It's not as safe as it could be or should be, but it's become safer. And it has been realized by fewer instances of bad outcomes, fewer instances of lawsuits, even though it should be going up. And if you stop and think about medical care and what medical care is able to achieve, if there are good outcomes that can be achieved today that couldn't be achieved 10 years ago, then there is an increased number of lawsuits that could be brought for failing to achieve those outcomes, and yet there are fewer cases. How come? It must be because the system is working. They're paying attention to our lawsuits, and they're becoming safer. Additionally, when you stop and think about healthcare, it's become more complex. There are more moving parts. There are more opportunities for errors that could cause harm. That's what the patient safety programs are all about, paying attention at each step. And therefore, one would assume that with more opportunity for error, there would be more errors and more lawsuits. And yet there are fewer. It's not that there are none. Maybe I'm rambling on, but if by an interesting insight into the study by the Institute of Medicine, they cited the work of the anesthesia medical specialty that began in the early 1980s, triggered because of the, quote, medical malpractice crisis. Of course, the crisis that they were talking about, the anesthesiologists, was, gee, we're paying a lot of money for our malpractice insurance. The crisis that the patients were experiencing included death and brain injuries that were the result of anesthetic care. So what did the anesthesiologists do commencing in the early 1980s? They were 3% of the physicians, by the way, and they were paying 11% of medical malpractice premiums. They studied closed medical liability cases to try to understand where the errors were taking place. Bear in mind, they couldn't study every anesthetic record and every hospital record. But with these closed cases, they had information as to what the doctors themselves had testified to, what the patients or patient families had testified to, and information from medical experts on both sides. And by anonymously studying these cases, they saw trends. They saw where there were errors being made. They corrected the errors, and the anesthesia specialty dramatically reduced the incidence of the most serious outcomes. They studied death and brain injury, injury to teeth, which is not a good thing, but they didn't study that so much. They wanted to eliminate the serious cases, and they made anesthesiology safe. The statistics cited by the Institute of Medicine in 2001 is that before their safety initiatives, 1 to 2 per 10,000 anesthetic procedures would result in a patient death. After their safety initiatives were instituted, it was 1 out of every 200,000 to 300,000 anesthetic procedures. The statistics couldn't be coincidence. It couldn't be unrelated to the safety initiatives. And the safety initiatives that they were using were similar to the approach used by the airline industry, in that every time there's something bad happens, we study it, we analyze it, we figure out what is the root cause of the injury and how do we make sure that it doesn't happen again. Now, medical care is more complex than what the airline industry does. No doubt it's complex in the airline industry, but it works, and they proved that it worked. Since 2001, other medical specialties dealing with serious cases such as perinatal brain injuries, dealing with obstetrical and perinatal care, they've also had similar studies. The Hospital Corporation of America, they deliver 200,000 babies a year. They initiated studies, and they had a 50% decrease in injuries to children and mothers, and a fivefold decrease in their cost of malpractice insurance. In other words, it works. And where did they learn what was going wrong? Well, they learned from these lawsuits. And so getting back to Mr. Spicer, who we certainly agree that frivolous lawsuits are, if you want to define frivolous as meritless or frivolous as having a minor or trivial injury, well, frivolous lawsuits are not a good idea. But it makes no sense to target the most serious injuries and call them frivolous. And I think your question was lawsuit abuse. I agree that no suit that lacks merit should be brought. And, you know, the phrase is you know, a courthouse door should be open and not closed. Well, you want to keep the courthouse doors open for meritorious cases, and I suppose you could pass a law and say, make sure your case is meritorious, but that's what the process is supposed to resolve. That's why you have a judge and jury to decide.
Steve, can private citizens serving on juries understand the medical facts necessary to decide a liability case and its merits, given the complexities that you've mentioned?
Attorneys who take on the representation of an injured patient must carefully screen the case, must understand the case, and then ultimately must have the skill and ability to communicate in a courtroom so that the jurors can and will understand. And if jurors do not understand when the case is over, our clients will be unsuccessful, because we have to establish our case based on what's called a fair preponderance of the credible evidence. So while I certainly rail against the idea of a crisis, we attorneys, those of us who have been doing this for many years, and I and a number of others have been doing this for many years, we must have been able to communicate to jurors in the courtroom in a way so that they can understand. In a patient who has had a cardiac arrest and has no ability to pump blood to her brain, heart, and all other organs, is in critical condition, and yet the resuscitation reverses the cardiac arrest. And when we're in the courtroom, we're saying, well, if only those efforts to treat the patient had been done before the cardiac arrest, it's reasonable to conclude that those efforts would be successful when the patient would be more responsive to those efforts in advance, before things became so dire. That's the kind of thing that jurors can understand. They can understand that a cardiac arrest is not good, there's no blood going to any of the patient's organs, and they can understand that successful efforts to reverse that, unfortunately, the patient in the interim could have irreversible harm and therefore have a severe injury or death. But jurors can understand that. And if I can't communicate to jurors in a way that they understand, shame on me. There's something wrong with me, and I ought to go into a different business. But so far, over a lot of years, I've never had jurors say to me, I didn't understand.
Are diagnostic errors an important health issue for the public?
It's interesting. The Institute of Medicine recently published a report that there continues to be harm in an unacceptable number of patients from diagnostic errors. And if you follow the Institute of Medicine since 2001 and up to the present time, they're always going to be dissatisfied with anything less than perfection. There never will be perfection. But diagnostic errors, not stated by attorneys such as myself who see the consequences of that, but by the Institute of Medicine, yes, they continue to occur, and they occur too often. But an interesting part of the discussion is that they've noted that medical liability insurers and hospitals and their professional risk managers have done what they call benchmarking studies using the liability cases to try to reveal where in the diagnostic process errors are most likely to occur. If you know that in advance, you can now teach safety. And to try to understand what factors contribute to errors, such as not having a proper system, not having good communication. Handoffs, for example. We're done with this patient. We're handing the patient off to the next set of care providers. Well, frequently that's where the ball gets dropped. So work a system out where you're paying attention when these handoffs take place. And an interesting concept, for example, coronary care units now have reduced mortality for patients in the unit from greater than 30% to around 5%, and survivors have increased cardiac reserve and increased quality of life. So how important is it in a quality of care issue to make a diagnosis of the patients who need to go into the coronary care unit and the patients shouldn't be sent home? So using statistics like that, one can understand how important it is for individuals, where it's matters of life or death or matters of quality of life, that these diagnostic errors do not occur. Nobody wants these diagnostic errors to occur. The providers who make such errors don't do it on purpose. But as the Institute of Medicine has stated, to err is human, and errors occur. So to answer your question, I haven't lost track of it. Do diagnostic errors occur, and are they important? Yes, they occur. They always will. And we always must work to try to reduce the incidence of these errors. It would be nice if we could create a national law in saying all healthcare providers must be perfect and never make errors. That law would be well-intentioned.
Stephen, it's been an honor to have you with us today, and it's been really educational for me, and I know for our listeners as well.
Stephen Pagalis, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Baby, I got a story I want to tell somebody. In my life I've seen a lot of things go down. I was the third brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive.